Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Mindshift Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, welcoming you back to another episode where we're going to be delving back into the world of the cults. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I did an episode on exploring the connection between evangelicalism and the world of the cults. And then after talking to Chris Kratzer about his book, Leatherbound Terrorism, I wanted to get back into the subject of the cults. And I found an advertisement on Facebook a few weeks ago, a woman named Laura Caput. She's from Melbourne, Australia. Her and her friend Stephen Unthank are both ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, and they're going to be doing a seminar about their stories about leaving the church or the movement, whatever you want to call it, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Watchtower organization. So I got a hold of Laura a few weeks back, and I was able to arrange a podcast interview with both her and Stephen, and we're going to hear that in just a few minutes. They're going to tell you their stories, and we're going to kind of expose a little bit of the inner workings of the Watchtower organization, the Jehovah's Witnesses, some of the secrets and things that they really would not rather come to light, especially around this area of child sexual abuse. And we're going to hear some pretty horrific stories, some pretty horrific statistics around this issue. This has become a real problem. It's been exposed more in recent years because the Watchtower organization has a very strict policy of every sin has to be reported according to their understanding of the Bible as evidenced by two or more witnesses. Now, the problem, of course, is in the case of child sexual abuse, a lot of times, of course, what you only have is the child and his or her abuser. So you can't report this problem. And if you do, the elders of the local kingdom hall that you're trying to report it to, the abuse victim, they'll simply respond by saying, well, you don't have two or more witnesses to this sin. They don't even necessarily consider it a crime. And so it goes unreported. And this is something that Stephen in particular is really passionate about. And this will become a lot more clear in a few minutes as we dive into his story. But I'm really interested too in talking to him and Laura about this journey of reconstruction, because as I'm discovering a lot of the parallels between evangelicalism and even mainstream churches and the world of the cults, as I explored in my first episode back in January, what I talked about in that episode, and I've been doing more research and talking to more people since then, that this idea of deprogramming, this is a word that comes out of the world of the cults, isn't it? You hear about ex-cult members needing to be deprogrammed as they've been brainwashed by their particular group or cult or group of, with undue influence, whatever they've been a part of. Well, this idea of what I've been calling reconstruction in an ex-evangelical sense is very, very similar to this idea of deprogramming. It's completely reorienting your whole worldview, your whole lifestyle, really. It's your whole learning to think and in completely different ways, act in different ways. And this is something that I get into, particularly with Laura and Stephen, later on in this episode. I want to find out how they've reconstructed coming out of the cult of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, what do we know about the Jehovah's Witnesses? Well, I just want to give a super quick rundown. Basically, the roots of the Jehovah's Witnesses go back to the mid or late 19th century in America. They actually trace their roots to the Adventist movement, and that began with a certain William Miller, who he was a Baptist lay preacher. Around about 1816, he started proclaiming that Christ was going to return in 1843, and this started a huge movement. And unfortunately, of course, that date came and went, and Christ did not return. Well, they changed that date to 1843, to 1844, then October of 1844, and of course, it didn't happen. Well, after the 1844 date came and went, Miller's following kind of fell apart, but one of the people who did come under the sway of the Adventist teaching was this man named Charles Taze Russell. He was born in February 1852 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he came out of the Presbyterian movement, but around about age 16, he started having a lot of doubts about the creeds, the doctrine, not only about God, but about the Bible itself. And what happened was he began to be influenced by some of these, what they call Second Adventist preachers. And really, if you trace the roots of the Jehovah's Witnesses, you'll see that they have some sort of theological threads, one of which is this idea of, you know, the end of the world, Jesus coming back, ushering in the end of the world. And these are what they draw from the Adventist roots. Now, if you ask a Jehovah's Witness what they believe, they don't necessarily, maybe they don't even know the actual ones who might come to your door. They don't necessarily know the whole history. They haven't been told the history. But this idea of predicting dates for the end of the world, this is something that the Jehovah's Witnesses are really keen on. They predicted the end of the world many, many times. They said that it was, that Christ was going to return in 1874. Then they said, well, he returned invisibly. Then they said, well, maybe it's 1878. Then they predicted the end of the world in 1914, and that didn't happen. And dates have been moved and moved and moved. 1975 was one of the more recent ones. The end of the millennium, the year 2000 was another one. And we see that this group, this movement that Charles Taze Russell started kind of morphed and went on into a very sort of militant thing when his successor came along, a certain Judge Rutherford, Joseph Franklin Rutherford. He succeeded in taking over the movement from Charles Taze Russell. And the way he did it was very similar. It reminds me a lot of the way David Miscavige took over the Scientology movement after L. Ron Hubbard died. He kind of pushed all the people that were against him out, and he became, under his leadership, Rutherford's leadership, the Watchtower organization became much more militant and much more antagonistic. And this has started where they started changing names. They might have called themselves the Bible Students, but in 1931, under Rutherford's leadership, they became known as the Jehovah's Witnesses, kind of distinguished them from some of the other splinter groups that had formed after Russell died. And this is kind of where the movement has developed over the decades since Russell and then Rutherford took over. They've had different leaders since then, and I would argue they've morphed more and more into a cult. They have some very interesting distinctives. For example, in 1961, they came out with a ruling that no Jehovah's Witness can have blood transfusions, and they reckon this has accounted for thousands and thousands of witnesses who have died, whose lives could have been saved, but for this ruling about not receiving blood transfusions. Some of the other things about the group, they don't believe in celebrating birthdays or holidays. They will not salute the flag, whatever country they're a part of, and they don't believe in any sort of military service. They have some very unique, distinct teachings, and these are very rigidly enforced by the leadership. So really, since the days of Rutherford, it's more about morphing from the dynamics of the leader and the leadership to about dynamic membership. They're much more invested in trying to get the individual member out witnessing on the street, pounding the pavement, handing out materials, proselytizing people, trying to convert them over into becoming a Jehovah's Witness. As the various presidents of the cult have come along since Russell and Rutherford and some of the others, it's really less about a single dynamic leader leading the organization, and it's morphed more into the leadership by a governing body, which is what produces basically all the literature in the Awake and the Watchtower magazines. And this is what you're going to see when people come to your door. Jehovah's Witnesses knock at your door, or you might run into them. I used to run into them every week when I get off the train in Liverpool when I was teaching up there. There was always two sets of Jehovah's Witnesses, one on either side of the street as I came out of Liverpool Central train station, and they were handing out Watchtower and Awake magazines. And sometimes I used to take them and bring them into class, and we would talk about it. And it's kind of interesting because all the articles, all the things in the Watchtower and the Awake magazine, they're written anonymously. There's no references. You don't know who's written them. And every Kingdom Hall all across the world, as I understand it, goes through the same information every week in their services. It's kind of a call and response sort of a thing, a rote thing where the person who's leading it, and they don't have any paid ministers. The elder who's leading the discussion is reading from the latest, whether it's an Awake or Watchtower magazine, as I understand it. And every Kingdom Hall goes through the same thing, and the members have to respond. So there's questions in the journal, and they respond according to the answers that are already provided. And so when we start thinking about cults and information control, emotional, behavioral control, this is classic, straight out of the cult's playbook, where we're talking about they control the information. Anyone who questions it, anyone who starts publicly questioning any of the teachings or the practices of the organization is in danger of being disfellowshipped, ultimately labeled an apostate and shunned. And this again is classic cult members. They exercise mind control. Members are basically told they have to go out and witness on the streets, knocking door to door, handing out Watchtower materials, or standing on the streets, like in my example at Liverpool Central. They're there every day on the street. And so they're very much into this Armageddon theology, the end of the world. They've predicted it, as I said, many, many times. And of course, it's been wrong. And yet, when they're confronted on this, you know, they've changed the date. Like I said, they said originally 1914, then they changed it to 1915, 1916, 1924, 1928, 1975, 2000. And you'll say, what about this? What about you're supposed to be a representative of Jehovah, of God himself? And of course, that's the name they believe that is the true name of God, is Jehovah. And he won't hear you. He won't listen to your prayers if you call him by another name. They'll say, well, there's just new levels of enlightenment. Those were the old lights. Now it's the new lights, and we've got new information, new levels of enlightenment. We didn't understand the Bible then, but we're getting it right now. And there's this levels of cognitive dissonance. And this is something that I'm curious to talk about with Stephen and Laura in this episode. So I don't know if that's helped you kind of unpack a little bit of the history and the theology and the cult-like mentality of the Watchtower organization and how it treats its members and how it interacts with the world. And this is something that particularly Stephen, but Laura also, is quite passionate about as they're sort of lifting the lid, shining the light on what's going on within the Watchtower organization, particularly around this issue of child sexual abuse, the cover-ups and the denial, and how this has been handled over the decades by the Watchtower organization, and where the movement finds itself currently, especially within different governments around the world. There's in Australia, there's been a royal commission into this investigation into this issue of child sexual abuse and how it's been covered up. And so Stephen and Laura are working very hard to get the information out there. And we're going to talk about how you can find that. They've got websites and as well as different social media connections if you want to get a hold of Stephen and Laura. So let's go on into lifting the lid, exposing the inner workings of the Watchtower organization, focusing especially on this issue of child sexual abuse and the cult-like nature of the movement. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Stephen Unthank and Laura Caput, all the way from Melbourne, Australia, as we get into exposing the inner workings of the Watchtower organization here on Mindshift Podcast. All right, I'm happy to be joined all the way from Melbourne, Australia, by Lauren Caput and Stephen Unthank. Thank you for being a guest on Mindshift Podcast.
You're welcome, Clint.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
It's been great to finally connect with you two. Both of you are ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, and I'm really interested to hear your stories. You're both coming out of the church. What was your backstory? I mean, were you both in Jehovah's Witnesses? Were you born into it? Did you join it as adults? Maybe we can kind of run through your stories and kind of give us a rundown of how you got out.
Sure. We were both born into the religion, but regarding myself, my father became a Jehovah's Witness just a month after I was born, and my mother never converted to the religion, and I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness my entire life. I left in my late 20s and then came back about 7 years later to try and get my brother and his wife and children out. And that took many years, and I was successful in doing that.
So you got them out. You say you came back. What do you mean you you rejoined the church to try to get them out, or you were just trying to rejoin and make connections with your family?
The first time I left, I put everything I had into a bag and a suitcase and walked away from everything and just what's called faded. And when I went back, I just reactivated myself and attached myself to the congregation my brother was in and spent years trying to slowly extract him out of the religion. And then once that was successful in 2009, I then formally resigned from the religion in writing. And there's a little bit of story to that, but we can go into that, the reasons behind that, a little bit later.
Yeah, as to why you have to actually resign in writing and why you got out. What made you decide that you were going to leave? That's a pretty dramatic move, especially if you've got family members still in the church. What was it that led you to say, okay, I've had enough, I'm going to walk away?
It's a long story. The introduction, I'll give a quick summary of it. When I was 12 years of age, I was sexually abused and raped by a very high-ranking leader of the church. And I tried to tell my father, but that was unsuccessful. And from the age of 13 onwards, I tried to get the matter sorted out in the church continually, non-stop. And I wanted a meeting with my rapist. I attempted that on maybe a dozen times over a dozen years. And eventually in 2008, I got a one-on-one meeting with my rapist during a big convention of Jehovah's Witnesses. I confronted him over what he did, and the very next morning, he had my implied invitation to attend all Jehovah's Witness gatherings in Australia revoked. He couldn't excommunicate me, so he took the other option of throwing me out of the religion by using the corporation to do it. So that meant if I attended any gatherings or a kingdom hall or a church or a building, I could be criminally charged with trespass and arrested. So what that did was that prevented me from being able to have a judicial committee formed to deal with his rape of me. And I contemplated that for another year and decided that it was too much for me to bear. I couldn't be associated with that religion. So I eventually formally resigned and started my attempts to protect the other children within the religion. And that's what I'm still doing now.
You're still fighting for that.
10 years later.
Well, I know that within Jehovah's Witnesses, this has historically been a problem whereby, because of their policy about not having more than two or three witnesses, if they don't have two or three witnesses to like in the case of sexual abuse, in the eyes of the church, it can't be substantiated. Is that what you came up against? That sort of policy that says, well, it's just your word against his, and so therefore we can't substantiate this allegation?
No, that was never used in my situation. When I met with other representatives of the governing body and other leaders of the church, they never doubted my story. The problem is that I didn't scream out when I was raped, so they classified it as fornication, consensual.
God,
and he was older man than me, much older. I'm much older than my father, and I was just 12. And so I had that situation to deal with. And that was very different to the two witness rule, because they never required me to prove that. In some of the discussions I had with various circuit overseers and elders, they never doubted that I was raped. It's just they used a loophole to protect the person. And what I did find years later through the Australian Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, or the Child Abuse Royal Commission for short, was that there are other victims of him before I was abused and after I was abused. It's the ones before I was abused that is the most serious, because they knew that he was a child rapist already, and he was not a representative of Jehovah's Witnesses in my local area. He was actually a representative of the headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses in the United States. They had sent him over, and he was in Australia as one of their representatives, and that's when he raped me.
So he had a history of doing this with other children, but are you saying that the church basically protected him to protect their own reputation? Is that what that sounds like what's happening here? They knew actually about his history, and he sounds like he's gone on to continue having contact with children. What's happened to the guy? Is he still in the system?
He is still in the system. I was led to believe a number of years ago that he had died. That turned out to be incorrect. He's so embedded in the Jehovah's Witness system that the church even obtained for him a Working with Children card, and he's directly involved in working with children within the religion. So there's not a lot more I can speak about at the moment, because upon finding out he was still alive, I went to the police, and it's now a matter within the police, and we're working through the evidence for that right now.
Right.
And when I say right now, I mean we have been with the police the last few months, taking witness statements, gathering the evidence, and compiling a dossier to have him held accountable as a child raping pedophile.
Did you mention that you found other children that were abused by this man?
I did, yes. I've met with them.
Right.
We never shared stories. We just shared the identification of our rapist, and they've made their statements to the police. Well, some of them have. One of them, I understand, was too scared to potentially lose all their family. And I'm not involved in any of their claims or cases. I'm not a witness for them, for anything that happened to them. It's just, it was a coincidence that we met, but we did meet because of the Child Abuse Royal Commission. We met through that arrangement.
Are you saying that this man basically has who knows how many children he's abused, but the church has covered it up? So you're leaving the church wasn't necessarily because of theological issues or issues that you had with it, with their teachings or anything like that. It was over this matter of the cover up and the way it was handled. It sounds like you were kind of kicked to the curb. It sounds like the church was protecting its own reputation. Is that what your assessment of it is? It sounds like there's more than one case for sure. This is a...
I wrote a letter of resignation, and I addressed it to Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania, not to the Jehovah's Witnesses. And in the letter, I never resigned from the Jehovah's Witness religion. I was careful for that. And I cited all matters relating to my abuse and the corporation's criminal aspect. And what was interesting in that, in 30 years of writing to the church and seeking a written response to my abuse, they never responded. But the moment I told Watchtower Pennsylvania I didn't want to be a part of that criminal organization, the church immediately announced I was no longer a Jehovah's Witness.
So they booted you out. That was their response, basically, to kick you out because you were trying to blow the whistle on what was going on. They kick you out. That's a pretty unbelievable response from someone who's supposed to be standing for the truth and the gospel message and all the rest of it, isn't it? Very ironic that that's how they respond to you trying to do the right thing here and expose the situation going on.
It's more than exposing. I was trying to get justice. They were hypocritical in their dealing with it. What they portray to the public within the religion and to the media and authorities was completely different to the way they dealt with me. They wouldn't meet with me. They wouldn't discuss the situation. They weren't interested in whether I had two witnesses or not. That didn't matter to them. All they did was they weren't after me. And it's unfortunate. It was painful. During the Child Abuse Royal Commission, Justice McClellan, who presided over it, he severely opposed the religion, and also Jeffrey Jackson, the leader of Jehovah's Witnesses from the governing body, about giving child abuse victims no justice and no alternative but to formally resign from the religion. And yeah, he could have been exactly talking about my situation, which is exactly what I presented to the Royal Commission.
There's a pattern there for sure. Well, what have they found statistically? Is this becoming a more and more well-known thing in Australia where more cases are coming forward in the Jehovah's Witnesses Church? What have been the findings of this Royal Commission?
The Royal Commission did a case study, number 29, into Jehovah's Witnesses. They were not going to do an investigation into the Jehovah's Witness religion, but I started a open dialogue with the Royal Commission and spent months and months and months trying to convince them to investigate Jehovah's Witnesses. And that was on the back of 2 years of lobbying, helping them to develop their terms of reference to to make sure Jehovah's Witnesses were included. So when the Royal Commission started, I pushed for the religion to be included. The Commission agreed. They subpoenaed all of the Jehovah's Witness records, and the statistics were staggering. In a population of 68,000 members in Australia within Jehovah's Witnesses, the government discovered just over 1,800 child sexual abuse victims within the church, and just over 1,000 alleged perpetrators. And with zero of them reported to the police or the authorities for investigation or prosecution. And they were staggering numbers.
That
is staggering. The ratio was far worse than any other religion in the country. The media was running stories on television almost constantly. In some instances, they were stating that this might be the worst religious cult within Australian history for child abuse. And it looks like it will go down as the absolute worst our country has ever, ever had. And now we're going through them, and we're going after them, and we're going to hold them accountable.
So you're fighting the good fight. Well, what is it in your understanding of Jehovah's Witness organization in particular that has led to so much of this child abuse? What is it about that system that is not only allowing people to continue to get away with it, but then not holding them accountable? What is it about that particular religion? Because obviously we could point to, you know, there's been many, many, many stories of, for example, the Catholic Church of covering up priests who have abused children and then moving them to other parishes where they continue to abuse. So this has long been a historic pattern within Catholicism. But what is it about Jehovah's Witnesses that makes it so unique and such a spike in those statistics?
One major difference between the Catholic Church and Jehovah's Witnesses is Jehovah's Witness leaders are allowed to get married and have children. And within the Catholic Church, the priests.
Yeah, they're celibate.
To understand the big problem in Jehovah's Witnesses, it's good to keep in mind the practice within the church of shunning. Shunning people who speak up or disagree with the church's teachings, even on child protection, is a very, very powerful tool. And with that power and those decisions over life and death, it creates a two-tier system. Religious leaders at the top with absolute power, and everybody else down the bottom, including men, women and children, with no power at all. And that makes the children susceptible to being victimized, to being targeted, bullied and to being abused. That's what I personally found. I had approached my abuser to get personal help with personal problems, and he was able to use his position to take advantage of me and do what he did to me.
Laura, we haven't heard from you yet. Do you have anything to add to what Stephen is saying about this issue of shunning and why this abuse happens?
There are a couple of other reasons why the Jehovah's Witnesses are problematic. The biggest one is shunning, as Stephen has explained. However, there's also an issue of a lack of education. For example, being educated is discouraged. So if you haven't been educated, how can you feel confident or be competent to approach the authorities, say, with a written letter of complaint? Another thing is that they're very poor, particularly among those that are really believing, because those people are spending most of their time proselytizing and studying the Bible and the Watchtower books. So they don't have time to go out and get a career. They're really limited in the amount of money that they can earn. So those things add to the situation. And you mentioned earlier on this two-witness rule. Other churches don't have this two-witness rule. And that is really preventing people, because of them not feeling confident that they will be believed, to come forward. And particularly because they were forced to face their abuser and three adult men.
So it makes it extremely difficult. They've created a climate or a culture whereby, as you say, the men in charge of the organization have almost unlimited control and power over the people in the congregation. And this has then fostered this environment of lack of accountability, really, isn't it? When an abuse situation happens, the child is pretty much powerless to say anything. And they've created this shunning, fearful environment where it's very difficult to speak up, and just in general, isn't it? Let alone when something very serious happens, like a child is abused, then you're not going to come forward, are they?
That's right. That's exactly right. And And so I just want to go back and tell you how I got out.
Yeah, we haven't heard your story.
It's not related
yet.
To child abuse at all.
Right.
But you'll see that Stephen and I came together as a result of the abuse issue. So the way that I got out of the Jehovah's Witnesses was I was born in, like Stephen. My parents were both Jehovah's Witnesses. They were very devout. We didn't have access to, for example, branded clothes. We didn't watch TV very much. We didn't have any friends outside of the Jehovah's Witnesses. I was very awkward. Stephen makes jokes saying, you know, how nerdy I was, how awkward I was. For example, my mum used to cut my hair and it really didn't suit me. Not having friends, not being able to play sports after school was really embarrassing. So I was really awkward for that reason as well. And generally, I was embarrassed about being a Jehovah's Witness. I didn't know at that time that it was a cult, but I knew it just wasn't right. There were quite a few people who just didn't act normally in our congregation. I guess there was an oversupply of weirdos, I guess.
They're just all a bunch of weirdos. They're just all weirdos. But you're saying it's a cult, though. That's the thing, isn't it? You're talking about a very closed kind of community. So, yeah, you're overprotected from the world. And, of course, you're going to be socially awkward within that system. Anyway, go ahead with your story. Mm.
Why I left, and I left at about age 19, is because, one, I really wanted an education. Two, we were sold the idea that we would live in paradise on earth forever. And Stephen explained earlier about the hypocrisy, not just about child abuse, but everything. It's a very hypocritical religion. And I did not want to live forever in paradise on earth with Jehovah's Witnesses. That wasn't an attractive thought to me. So while everyone was thinking about playing with tigers because they would be tame and having an everlasting life, that terrified me because I didn't like being a member of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And then the third thing was that women couldn't be in a leadership position. And at that time, I was really quite ambitious. I wanted to go up the corporate ranks and I wanted to try all sorts of experiences in life. So the fact that only men could be elders and only men could be ministerial servants or overseers made it really an unattractive religion because I thought, well, what's my place? I don't want to be a mum and I don't want to be a wife. So I really don't fit. So really it was a very different reason to Stephen that I left. And when I left, I had a similar experience to him in that once I was gone, we were shunned. And he's explained before how serious that shunning is. I have not had a conversation in over a quarter of a century with my uncles, my aunts, my cousins in a free way that we could just ring each other and say happy, you know, Merry Christmas or Happy New Year. It's just not possible. And so on the day that I left, I knew that would happen. And I was prepared, like Stephen, to leave everything behind. It was that important to me.
You walked away as well, knowing there was a huge social cost to be paid. Well, both of you have said, you've mentioned the word cult. I was curious to find out what you thought of the religion, because if it is a cult, a lot of the markers definitely fit the sort of classic cult stereotypes that sociologists have identified, don't they? You talk about shunning and a very closed system, a very male-dominated Armageddon sort of theology. They've got this end of the world. I mean, how many times has the Watchtower organization predicted the end of the world? Many, many times. And obviously, it's never come to pass. So They fit all the classic criteria of a typical mainstream sort of cult, don't they?
Right.
Well, just in my own lifetime, I was subjected to end of the world predictions twice. Once in 1975, and that greatly affected me as a young child. And again, starting in 1984, they started making statements in their publications that the system that we're in will end before the end of the 20th century. In other words, before the year 2000, the end would come again. And it didn't happen. Two lots of being subjected to that, twice as a child and then once as an adult. As an adult, I didn't believe it at all. Because by that time, I'd already done my historical research and found that they had predicted the end in 1914, 1925. It suits their agenda.
It does suit their agenda. And every time it didn't come to pass, 100 years ago, they would just revise their dates and say, well, okay, we meant 1921 or we meant 1935 or whatever the new date was. And so the followers just bought it hook, line, and sinker. I mean, that's my question, is how does the average Jehovah's Witness live with that cognitive dissonance? I mean, if you're told that the end of the world is going to come on this particular specific date and it doesn't happen, and this is an organization that's supposedly hearing from God himself, Jehovah himself, and then they get it wrong, why don't people just say, this is nonsense, why we're giving this up? But yet they don't. They continue to accept the excuses that the organization gives. How can they live with that cognitive dissonance?
That's a really good question. I personally couldn't live with it, but most do. And it's very unusual, actually, that there's someone who didn't believe it, because most of the people that I've met in support groups, and there are tens of thousands of people in support groups, they actually did believe it. They couch it as something that they call new light. And what they mean by that is that they have been able to better interpret the numbers or better interpret the writings in the Bible. And so they say, well, previously we didn't understand that. Now we do understand it better. It's called new light. And the old policies or the old doctrines are called old light, essentially. And so that has been going on now for a long time, and people are seeing through it. The way that they're seeing through it is because of, one, the Royal Commission, and that was a really huge line in the sand, but two, because of the internet and because of smartphones, news travels where it didn't used to be able to travel. So in the past, you relied on, if you had a cousin in another country, they could tell you what was going on there.
Exactly.
But now we're all on a support group, and we can share, you know, what story came out in another country 2 hours ago. So I think because of access to information, it's really changing the dynamic. And whereas previously the watchtower had the upper hand, now us apostates have the upper hand. And instead of them chasing us out, we're chasing them to be accountable.
Sounds like you're doing some really amazing things. One of the hallmarks of cults is information control. And as long as they can control the flow of information to their followers, as you say, they've got the upper hand. But now what is it that you're doing to, as you say, reverse that tide? Now you've got the upper hand because of the internet and social media. How are you able to get the message back into the watchtower? Or is that what you're trying to do? Are you trying to get the word into people who are currently still in the system about the truth as to what's going on?
I did not know all of this. I just knew that I left because I wasn't comfortable being a Jehovah's Witness. And I happened to also have a couple of stories within my family. Four people in my family were abused as children by Jehovah's Witnesses. So with that, I went to the Royal Commission and I shared our stories with the Commission. Then I found these support groups. And within the support group, I saw Stephen and I recognized his surname because our families had been friends when we were children. And I heard about the work that Stephen was doing. If you look up Stephen Unthank's name, you'll find there's a plethora of information out there on work he's been doing politically and that he has been working on, for example, inquiries. As he mentioned before, he was associated with the Royal Commission, helping them to understand why we needed them. And you'll also see transcripts and other documents that he's created for people to understand the Jehovah's Witnesses. For example, he's created a document on something called theocratic warfare, and theocratic warfare is to Jehovah's Witnesses a permission to lie and to lie to authorities. So when I saw all of this 2.5 years ago, I really reached out to him and I wanted to start helping him, and that got us to where we are today. Now, you found us because I was advertising a public talk that we're giving next month. And
yes,
it's a talk for the humanist associations. We've given talks for them before. So we did all this privately, quietly, behind the scenes, until we got together as a team last year. And it was only last year that we started going public. And we wanted to be public because doing things behind the scenes is not as helpful to other people. Coming forward and being public means that people can see the work. So to answer your specific question, what are all the things we're doing? An example is, Stephen, you run a website called JW Leaks.
Yes,
do you
want
to say something in brief about that?
Yes, JW Leaks has been on the internet since 2012. I originally started the website to collect documents on how the religion handles child abuse and in the court in relation to that, and to assist attorneys and lawyers and governments around the world. Over the next couple of years, the website really took off with a lot of documents that they're able to provide to people. And a lot of people would provide documents to me that they leaked from the headquarters. I ended up compiling everything together, and that was used by the Australian Royal Commission when they did their study on Jehovah's Witnesses. And once the Royal Commission handed down its findings, I then archived the website and decided to move on. After Watchtower launched action against me in the United States Federal Court, I was informed of that, so I relaunched the website last week and published some documents on there about their real estate transfers in Brooklyn, and also information that leads to a conclusion that it's quite possible they had defied court orders in the sale of one of the properties. So we'll wait to see whether anything comes of that. But I'm not the person that they're going to sit there and bully. If they leave me alone, then I won't do anything. But they can't leave me alone. They keep going after former members or people that have made a complaint to the police or people that appeared before the Royal Commission. They go after these people to harass them, to intimidate them, and to bully them. That's where the cult is.
I was going to say, it sounds remarkably similar to what Scientology does, isn't it? Where they actually will go after what they call suppressive people, anyone who is saying bad things about the church, and they will harass and intimidate and do anything in their power to silence their critics so that the church isn't happy about what you're doing. So it sounds to me like it's more about exposing the practices of the church and less about, as you say, getting people out like your brother, Stephen. You're not necessarily trying to get Jehovah's Witnesses out of the organization. It's more about shining a light just publicly on some of the practices of the church. Is that more what your mission is?
Correct. I'm not interested in their doctrines, their theology, their eschatology, their changing in teachings. I'm interested in the aspects of the corporations where the culture may be in breach of corporate laws in different countries. But what I've been focusing on is informing law enforcement agencies, advising governments around the world, and assisting in court cases for people to get justice. And one good example of that is last year, Lara and myself launched a new website on July the 26th. It was saysorry.org. And in there, the intention is to encourage the leaders of Jehovah's Witnesses to say sorry to the child abuse victims, to say sorry for the shunning that they cause, not the religious-based shunning, but the shunning that they use to control and bully and intimidate people. That's a violation of one's basic rights. But with the website, we were able to put together about 10 years of work that we had accomplished and roll it into one single website that's not about leaking documents, that's not about religious discussions or anything like that. It's just a platform for governments and organizations to collect some information, but more importantly, to learn a bit about Lara and myself. So in August and September last year, both Lara and myself did a European trip. We went through many countries in Europe, meeting with government organizations, meeting with law enforcement agencies, meeting with various former Jehovah's Witnesses, and we published quite a lengthy blog on the website about all our activities, where we went, who we met with. That contains a lot of information in there, and that's a really good summary of what Lara and myself are currently doing at the moment.
I'll give you an example of that, Clint. On saysorry.org, there are 44 stories that we collected from the Royal Commission website. The Royal Commission website has got thousands of stories, but only a small percentage were Jehovah's Witnesses because we're a small percentage of Australian. And so we collected 44 of them. You can read all of their stories. These are stories as told to the Commission that have been paraphrased. What we have been able to do is get some of them recorded verbally, runs a YouTube page called Responsible Witness, and she voices those stories. And so people can either read or listen to other people's stories. Now, the reason why we did that is because we want to encourage other people to come forward and know that they're going to be supported. Another thing that we did in the European trip is we attended a protest, and that was the primary reason why we went there. There was a protest put on by our friends in London, and the protest was 4 days. Yeah, so we attended a protest in London. That's primarily what our European trip was for. And because we were going there, we then met with the activists and the government department. And that's it in a nutshell, the type of work that we've been doing. We have been providing information publicly in talks, providing information on websites to get to the right audiences. We've also been attending protests. There's one coming up in Melbourne this year. And we've gone to see public officials in multiple countries to tell them about these issues. So they're some of the ways that our activism is playing out.
And it's working too, because in our European trip, we were able to meet with both government and law enforcement agencies and get a lot of investigations commenced into the Jehovah's Witnesses. We travelled through England, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, where we're able to encourage activities there in exposing the harm Jehovah's Witnesses cause. And those governments were very responsive. Some of them have taken action at the moment. And what is interesting is when we got back to Australia, we were able to have meetings with the Australian government in various departments. We were invited to Canberra to meet with politicians from both sides of government to talk about the problem within Jehovah's Witnesses. The government's monitoring the Watchtower Society in Australia at the moment very, very closely. The government is not happy with the way that Watchtower is operating. Watchtower's refusing to apologise or engage in the redress scheme for child abuse victims. So the government is prepared in the next month or two to go public with Watchtower's failure to respond. Watchtower is not even willing to respond to any communication from the government about potential compensation to victims. But we've had a lot of meetings with people, and it's interesting that one of the people that was very successful within the Watchtower Society in Europe in stopping the governments from investigating was a Watchtower leader by the name of Paul Gillies. And he was had a lot of success in providing governments with information and causing governments to not investigate. So part of our trip through Europe was following in his footsteps and undoing all the harm that he was sent to cause. We got some of those investigations open. We provided the real truth, and that's with a small T, not a capital T, which is what the church uses to spin their version of truth.
Yes.
Was it successful? Yes, because this month the church had Paul Gillies on their television network explaining that he's now in charge of the Office of Public Information, where he will be assigned to providing these very people their new version of what is truth. So we've got this battle going on. We're right. meeting with the government and he's trying to present another story, but we will win because we've got the victims with us. We're meeting with the victims. He's not meeting the victims, which means whatever the governing body put on their TV network is a sanitized version that is nothing but lies.
It sounds like they're trying to protect it. I mean, is that what you think is going on here? Is it ultimately about just protecting the organization full stop and they don't want the truth to come out? Because obviously if the floodgates open or they are opening now, you're in the process of shining a brighter and brighter light on the Watchtower worldwide, not just in Australia and in America. What do you see happening in the next 5 or 10 years? What would you like to see happening?
Yes, you're right. So that's the second time that you've mentioned, is it about their PR and is it about them saving face?
Yeah, is that what it's all about?
100%, that's what it is. They are the masters of spin and they will protect themselves at all costs. And when I mean at all costs, I really mean at all costs.
Literally.
At the cost of children. So what we think will happen is that they might fold one legal entity and start a new one. They've done that before. It's called phoenixing, when you dissolve an entity just to start a new one. They might try something like that. They might fold. If you remember the News of the World that was owned by, is that Rupert Murdoch? It was owned by, yeah.
Yes.
He realised that there was too much risk and he shut up shop of that publication, News of the World. They might do something like that, where they just shut up shop. Or they might start, you know, a whole new branding. For example, they might call themselves the Christian Congregation. And that way they've got some similar wording in their organisation, but they detach themselves from the brand that's now been sullied. So that's a couple of things that might happen. Of course, it would be best for everyone if they folded. But that wouldn't necessarily mean a perfect world because, as you mentioned before, people still have cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
They will be lost and stunned. And so what will happen is a lot of people will come out and they're going to need mental health services. because they are still indoctrinated. They have this deep belonging, sense of belonging, and they won't be comfortable in the world. So I really see a lot more people coming out and being disoriented. For ourselves, because you asked earlier on, Clint, about how we reconstructed our lives, and we didn't yet get to answer that. One way that Stephen's doing it is through his activism, and there's other things that he's done, such as study, and I'll let him tell you that. But the way that I did it was I needed help, and I went to a psychologist, and I had 10 sessions with a psychologist, and I went and sat in bookshops, and I read about self-help methods, and I did cognitive behavioral therapy with the psychologist, and it took about 10 years. So I'd be interested in knowing about how long it takes other religions. I found that it takes about as much time out as you were in to recover. So I'm interested in knowing your opinion on that, Clint.
Well, I think it's a lifetime process, really, because no matter how you disentangle yourself, it's like you said, we were in it for years and years and years, and then it's another lifetime to get out. Things can trigger us, even though you think, okay, I'm completely over that. Something can happen, and suddenly all these emotions and things come into play, and you're not ready for it, and then you've got to go back and deal with that. You thought, I thought I was all done with that. So it's a process, yeah. I think, isn't it? I know for me, it's a lifetime process.
You're rebuilding your life. You want to tell us something about your process?
One of the main things that I did was once the council assisting the Royal Commission handed down his submission on how bad it was in Jehovah's Witnesses, I considered a big chapter of my life had been concluded. So I enrolled in university to do a 4-year honours degree course in construction management. And in 2016 and 2017, I went full-time for that. In 2018, last year, I took a year off, and this year and for the next few years, I'll be doing the course part-time. And what that means is I'll be doing a module or a subject every now and then. I have 7 years to complete the degree, and that was just something that I decided to do to help me get a change of subject. But what I did in the first 2 years was I picked a lot of the management subjects and a lot of the law subjects that would benefit the ex-Jehovah's Witness community, particularly in relation to how to properly prepare academic papers, how to research and write reports for government organisations. So they were the electives that I concentrated on the most so that I could improve my writing ability there. And it's been very beneficial for me. It's helped me a great deal.
Kind of moving on with your life and starting a new chapter, really, it sounds like, as far as learning how to kind of reintegrate back into society. You mentioned earlier that education wasn't a very high priority in the Watchtower organization. So getting a degree, that's a big step, isn't it?
It is. One of the very first things in the first semester that I learned at university was critical thinking skills.
Yes.
And one of the things that struck with me was, don't accept something at face value or what someone says. Do your research. Is that quote correct? Is the article properly written? Is it referenced? And in addition to that, my own basic thinking and analysis on different things. But the first thing that struck me as it was sort of like a smack in the face was that Jehovah's Witnesses criticize critical thinking, and they often associate it with the word critical. In other words, you're criticizing a religion. That's not what it's about.
Not what it
means. I could see straight away why the religion was scared of people getting education. The first thing people are taught at university is how to analyze an article, how to read something and see if it's the truth. And that's exactly what the religious leaders don't want you doing with a Watchtower magazine, because
exactly,
they don't reference anything.
I was going to say, I've read plenty of Watchtower tracts, you know, being handed things on the streets and things. And I've always been struck by that there's never any external references other than their own materials or their own translation of the Bible. And so you just have to accept that it's their governing body or whoever the experts are that are writing this material. They don't even tell you who writes the material. There's not even an author's name in attached to most of the material, is it? So you don't even know. It's just coming out of the main organization in New York. Isn't that where it all basically comes from, all the material that they produce?
Yeah, there are some local areas that do writing, as well, but generally it's the direction is coming from the head office.
Yes.
I just remembered something else, Clint, about reconstructing your life, some really basic things which you might identify with or your listeners might, and that is, as a woman, we essentially wore long skirts mostly, and we wore petticoats underneath them, and always pantyhose or stockings. You know, we wouldn't have cleavage on show, and, you know, we generally wore makeup and did our hair and so on. It was all very Deptford wives.
Very all about modesty.
One of the things that I did when rebuilding my life was to challenge myself on the way that I was dressing and the way that I was presented. And I had to find my own fashion, for the sake of a better term.
Your own style.
You know, my skirts got shorter and I didn't wear petticoats as much. And if I didn't feel like wearing the stockings, I didn't. But they're the little things that you've got to think about when you're rebuilding your life, because from being controlled, you suddenly can do anything you like. When I moved out of home, I deliberately put my feet on the table because I'd been told not to as a child. When I left home, I also ate a lot of junk food because we didn't as a child. And I became a teenage alcoholic. And a lot of people become alcoholics, drug addicts, engage in really risky behavior, such as unprotected sex or many partners. And so people really go over the top because they haven't had the chance to find their own, if you like, their drumbeat.
Yeah, their own way, life. Their own path.
And so they want to try all the, sorry, say that again.
Yeah, they have to find their own path, basically, don't they?
That's right. So many people go overboard, and I certainly did board with alcohol. And then, so I had to reconstruct myself again without being an alcoholic. And that was a long journey. Like I said, it took about 10 years. And so I'm interested in knowing, when you interview the other people from different religions, if the same thing happened to them, because I think the more controlled a religion you come from, the more likely it is that it takes a long time to reconstruct. And there are many aspects of your life that you need to work on.
And certainly a lot of pitfalls that you could fall into. As you say, that's a very good point. I think that the more controlled you are in the religion, then when you finally experience freedom, people can just go completely sideways, and then they've got to recover from all the damage that they've done now in this reconstruction, yeah. And then they've got to reconstruct from the reconstruction. So yeah, that's a very good point. I'll definitely pose that to some of the other people I talk to. I'm aware of the time too. I know you have another call coming in for another interview. I don't want to keep either one of you too long, but I was just going to ask, how can people get a hold of you? You mentioned your website. How can people get a hold of you in terms of social media if they want to follow up and maybe get more resources from you?
Well, I'm on Facebook, just with my name.
Right, people
also,
can look you up.
Also, if people go to the saysorry.org website, they can see on the side the Facebook account for Say Sorry, and that's got just under 16,000 followers at the moment, and that's a great way to connect with people, including myself. I'm also on various forums under my username, JW Leaks. I think Lara's in the exact same situation.
Yes.
Yeah, I also have a Facebook group with my own name and my own photo, which is quite rare because half the people have an alias because they don't want their family to find out that they're seeking information. And people have previously contacted me, and I've connected them to the person who's the administrator of our support group. There are two huge support groups. There's one on Reddit with 40,000 followers, and there's another one called Jehovah's-Witness.com, and that also has 30,000,
right.
Sorry.
But
there's
following.
Also lots of groups. There's a public group that is open called, for example, XJW Open Discussion, something like that. And then there's private groups as well in your local area. For example, if you want to find people from your congregation who have left, there's usually private secret groups. And if you let it be known that you're seeking some old friends and which congregation you're from, usually someone will find you. It's not that hard to find you if you're searching.
Right.
Other ways that they can get in contact, I also record a podcast like you, Clint. Mine is called JW Community Podcast, and we often have guests who were former Jehovah's Witnesses on that podcast, and we try and get them to help others that aren't quite confident yet. And they can come to our talk. We've got the public talk with the humanists next month. There's an ad for it on Facebook. Just look up either of our names, Lara Kaput or Stephen Unthank. But you don't have to contact just us. There are many people out there that want to help former Jehovah's Witnesses to recover, and current Jehovah's Witnesses. We want to help current Jehovah's Witnesses to fade if they want to. There's many places you can reach out for help.
So there's a lot of great resources just between the two of you, it sounds like, and then you can point people to other resources on top of that. If you're looking to get out of the Watchtower organization, it's not an easy decision, is it? Not by any stretch, especially if you, as you say, you've got family and friends who are still in the system. It's a tough decision for yourself, but then to try to go back in as Stephen did, you were able to get your brother out, it sounds like, but that was a very difficult and tough thing to do, wasn't it?
It was, yes. One of the people often will send me a message through Facebook on how I got my family out. It can work different for different people. In my situation, I just helped my brother to make a complaint against the church elder, and I told him that you'll be able to see the love of the Christian religion come to protect you against this bully elder. But I knew very well that the religion would protect the bully elder, and that's what happened.
That's exactly
what
happened.
And that's what started him on the process of waking up.
He woke up and got out too. Well, you did a good thing by helping him get out. Well, listen, I know I don't want to keep you too long. You've got another call coming in, I think, from the States. So I will let you go. Listen, thank you, Laura and Stephen. This has been a fantastic conversation. I've learned a lot more about the Watchtower organization for sure. And it's made me think, okay, I've got to go back and do some more research on that whole subject as well. So I'll be looking up some of the resources that you two have. So thank you so much for being a part of the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us. It's vitally important that people who aren't Jehovah's Witnesses understand these former Jehovah's Witnesses. So your service is really important. We need the public to be interested and to get an understanding. So thank you so much for your invitation.
Well, I hope this has been a helpful and informative discussion with my guest this week, all the way from Melbourne, Australia. Stephen Unthank and Laura Caput, both ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. I find their testimony quite compelling, listening especially to Stephen's story about being sexually abused and his long fight to get recognized. And it's quite shocking, I guess, in a way, listening from the outside, how the Watchtower organization treated him. And really, he left the church or the organization not because of theological reasons, but over this issue of him not being believed, him not being supported in any way, shape, or form. And hearing Laura, too, talk about her journey of reconstruction, and it's really made me think, too, that this is something I've learned from Laura, and that is that reconstruction, there's another aspect to it. I've always kind of thought originally that deconstruction was the goal, that questioning your beliefs, questioning the group or the cult that you may have been a part of, that was the aim, waking up, if you will, and then getting out. But actually, I've realized not only that, but there's more to it. You've got to then reconstruct or deprogram from the things that you were taught while you were in the cult or in the group that you were a part of. But then, as Laura reminded us, you've got to be careful because sometimes that freedom can go too far. You can actually go kind of sideways in all the newfound freedom, and she developed this issue of being a teenage alcoholic. And then, in addition to all the other stuff, having to deal with the reprogramming, the reconstruction coming out of the Watchtower organization, she now had to go back and deal with becoming an alcoholic. So that was another sort of side effect or side issue that came out of her reconstruction. So I think we've got to really look at this whole thing, especially if you're coming out of a cult, coming out of a very controlling organization, some organization with undue influence. There's a complete reconstruction of your entire former worldview, something that Robert Lifton calls doubling. This is what happens when you're in a cult or in a controlling group. There's almost like there's another self that develops alongside your authentic self, and it's this process of doubling, and you have to kind of, you have to construct this self. You suppress your authentic true self in order to fit in with the group, in order to maintain your sort of levels of cognitive dissonance without going crazy. And then when you get out of the group, when you get out of the cult, you've got these kind of like two selves. This doubling has occurred, and you've got to go back and reconstruct your original sort of authentic self. So there's a lot involved in that. You might need counseling, as Laura did. You might need therapy. You might need to seek the guidance of a professional to help you reconstruct your own original or authentic identity, the one that was suppressed all the time that you were in this controlling group. And I think this is another thing I've learned from Laura, that the longer you're in a group like that, the more controlling it is, the longer it'll take you to deprogram and reconstruct. The more controlling it is, the more difficult it's going to be to reconstruct and deprogram. So these are things that we need to work on if you're in this process of being deprogrammed or coming out of a controlling group, a group with undue influence, or a cult like the Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, what's coming up in the next couple of weeks? Well, I've got a fantastic interview lined up with Rick Ross. He is a cult expert from the United States. You can look up his website at culteducation.com. We're going to be talking to him in a couple of weeks. That episode's going to be dropping. I've got a whole laundry list of questions for Rick. I'm absolutely fascinated at this issue of the cult playbook, if you will. How do cults maintain control over their followers? How is it that so many cults all over the world have a very similar set of playbooks or tactics that they use to control their members? And how does it all work? And there's a whole lot of questions I've formulated. So I hope you'll come back in 2 weeks for my discussion with Rick Ross as we unpack, explore in more detail the world of the cults, the cults playbook, and this issue of deprogramming or reconstruction. How does it all work? And what has been his experience in helping people come out of the various controlling groups that he has worked with over the decades? So I'm going to be interested to talk to Rick Ross. Come back in 2 weeks. Join me again. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at MindShift2018 if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, feedback on this or any other episode. So thanks again for joining myself, Laura Caput, and Stephen Unthank, expose a little bit in more detail the Watchtower Organization as we have listened to these ex-Jehovah's Witnesses speaking out. So I will see you in 2 weeks with Rick Ross right here on MindShift Podcast.